Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm General Ron Elving.
And I'm Corporal Punishment.
And Ken, congratulations to you on your distinguished military career.
I was killed in Vietnam in 1965. What is going on with politicians and their resume with military matters?
We have talked about this before. We talked about it in the famous case of Richard Blumenthal, got all this started, the Connecticut Attorney General who has claimed for years to have been, quote, in Vietnam, where it turns out he was serving during Vietnam, and that has apparently inspired an entire generation of newspaper and television and broadcast journalists all over America to look into the military claims of other candidates. Have they found anything, Ken?
Well, before, what's remarkable about this whole thing is that shortly after the Blumenthal brouhaha, Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah suggested a little amendment saying it would be a crime to embellish your military record in public. And who did that?
Oh, well, where should we begin? Among the more notables, I suspect, is Congressman Mark Kirk in Illinois, who, it turns out, has said that he was the Naval Intelligence Officer of the Year.
First of all, he didn't know which year. He kept going back from 1998 to 1999.
There was a little problem there. But the larger problem was that is an honor he never won.
Right.
And that is an honor given by the Navy. And what he was actually referring to was an honor given to a unit he was associated with by another entity, not officially by the Navy.
And as it turned out, what he meant to say is that for years he loved watching McHale's Navy on television.
And it was just a little unfortunate because it came up so often and it was in his official campaign material as recently as this year. And there's another reason why I think it might be unfortunate for Mark Kirk, and that is he is a relatively local politician, a congressman from northern Illinois, in a rather large state, most of which has never heard of him until now. This is his introduction to them. Whereas Blumenthal had the advantage of having been a statewide figure for what?
20 years, right.
And this is probably not the first time people have heard of him and probably not the only thing they know about him. But right now, those things are true for poor Mark Kirk.
Well, the Democrats, it's perfect for the Democrats of Illinois for two reasons. One, they have been on the defensive for years over there. Senate candidate for the Senate, Alexei Giannoulias, whose family owns the bank that has given, shall we say, suspect loans to mob figures.
The former bank. Yes, and at the age of, a distinguished age of 34, he was looking a little bit on the light resume side anyway, but the only thing people really do know about him before his political service was this association with this bank.
And this week, as we speak, the Rod Blagojevich, speaking of another name I can't pronounce, the Rod Blagojevich trial begins, jury selection begins, and this is another thing that the last thing the Democrats want to be reminded of, because after all, it was Rod Blagojevich who attempted to sell, as the allegations go, sell the very Senate seat that we're talking about.
You know, there have been some other questions raised about past military records. Some of the old disputes about Daryl Issa, the congressman who was going after the Joe Sestak matter, we're going to talk about it in just a moment. But Daryl Issa from California had said that he was part of a bomb squad protecting Richard Nixon at the World Series in 1971. Turns out Richard Nixon did not attend the World Series in 1971, and there were some other discrepancies in his record as well. And then a rather curious case of the governor of Arizona, the controversial governor there, Jan Brewer, with respect to the new immigration law. People have said some very rough things about her.
Although
someone has, among other things, called her Hitler's daughter. And she was outraged by that, of course, and she said, "And my father died fighting the Nazis in World War II."
When exactly did her father die?
In 1955, 10 years after the end of World War II, and he, in fact, had not been a combat soldier in the European theater, but I'm sure he was very much against the Nazis.
I was.
And was still fighting them in 1955, as were we all. But the question of political integrity, Ken, it's also going to the critique of the White House for its handling of a couple of cases where they tried to, well, shall we say, incentivize, if not muscle, candidates out of races in Colorado and Pennsylvania.
No,
they didn't try to muscle them out. If they tried to muscle them out, it'd be different.
You're reading it wrong. President Barack Obama promised when he was elected he would be creating jobs. And so he's creating jobs for Joe Sestak in Pennsylvania, Andrew Romanoff.
One job.
Right?
Yeah.
Andrew Romanoff in Colorado.
So it's a promise cap.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying? It's
exactly.
A promise cap.
Unlike the Prime Minister of Japan, who had to resign because of that Okinawa thing.
All right. Well, let's look at all the different ways that this might be wrong or might be important. In the Sestak case, some people have alleged that if the White House directly offered him a job, that would be a violation of law. But it's also generally the view of prosecutors that it's not the kind of thing that has ever been prosecuted or really was the intent of any of the laws that were written that might cover it?
Well, both are correct. I mean, there is a United States Code 600, I guess, that says it's a felony to offer somebody either a position.
Emolument.
Or something to get somebody out of
an inducement.
Right, exactly. Whereas, you're absolutely right, that this has happened in the past. So
we've seen these.
Is it illegal? Perhaps. Has it ever been
prosecuted?
No. And does this go on a lot? It probably does.
Well, my question is, if they really wanted to get these guys out of the race, why didn't they offer them a little bit more substantial carrots? I mean, they were very puny little carrots that were being put on the table here. And if they were going to threaten them with something, what was the stick? Where did they threaten them? Where, in what sense was muscle applied? I mean, the real critique seems to be here that the White House has wanted to weigh in on these races, but has failed in every case to move out the candidates they didn't want to have run. And in each case, it appears, at least, Sestak won, and it's possible that Andrew Romanoff in Colorado will wind up being the Democratic nominee there as well.
Maybe he's trailing the polls. They did have success with David Paterson in New York. They asked him, he said, please do not run for again. And I think they were only supported by 85% of the population of New York.
There were the polls and the stories that subsequently came out and clearly drove Paterson out. But I'm not sure the White House could have gotten him out on its own.
And one candidate they tried to get in was Lisa Madigan in the Illinois Senate race, because they wanted somebody with statewide appeal to run for the Obama Senate seat, and she said no.
You mean even if they threatened her with a federal job?
Well, actually, all I know is that Bill Clinton was in Arkansas last week. I thought campaigning for Blanche Lincoln. Perhaps he was offering her a job. Maybe.
That's also possible.
That's another rumor. Was Bill Halter offered something in Arkansas? Was Harold Ford Jr. in New York offered something to stay out of the Kirsten Gillibrand seat?
And people at the time thought maybe they were getting into those races specifically and explicitly in order to be offered something that they might like to have. But, you know, Ken, we're talking about a lot of things that really, to most voters, I think are just distractions. And maybe that's what the podcast is for. But there are enormous issues facing the administration, facing the nation, starting with this oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, which continues unabated. And apparently, since none of the things that have been tried since our last podcast have worked, indefinitely.
Everybody's saying that this is the worst week for the administration in between what's going on in the Koreas, the Israeli raid on the flotilla.
The Gulf oil. One thing that is going on in the media right now is a contest to see who can compare this to the biggest disaster. Is this Barack Obama's Katrina? Is this Barack Obama's 1979 Iranian hostage crisis, Jimmy Carter? How big is it?
Well, everybody's doing these facile comparisons. Daryl Issa, the congressman we just talked about, when he was talking about the Sestak affair, called it Barack Obama's Watergate.
Now, my theory is that as soon as somebody calls something somebody else's Watergate, that means we're over the top. We've jumped the shark. It's time to move on to another subject, because that person who's using that comparison is clearly out of gas and is using that comparison to try to revivify interest in the issue.
But when you think of President Obama talking to the American people, or at least having that nationally televised press conference, and then going, of course, down to the Gulf to try to do whatever he can, although I don't know what he can do, does his administration look like it's just flailing, or does it look like it's taking charge?
I think everyone looks like they're flailing. Yeah. You know, and in one of those perfect ironies of timing, even as we were all focused on the Gulf itself, there were primaries going on in two of the Gulf states last week, in Alabama and in Mississippi, and they produced some surprising results, especially in Alabama.
That's true, and the big news, of course, was Alabama, when the supposed frontrunner for the Democratic nomination, Congressman Archer Davis, African-American, four-term congressman, was not only lost to his white opponent, Ron Sparks, the state agricultural commissioner, but he got trounced 62-38. And this was a race where every poll showed Archer Davis ahead. Where did he go wrong? Actually, where didn't he go wrong?
Yeah, he lost across the board. In fact, it appears he won in only two of the 11 counties in Alabama that have a majority population of African Americans. Here's a guy trying to be the first black governor of Alabama.
Wait. Before you say that, because everybody says that, there's only been four black governors. As you well know, there's PBS Pinchback in Louisiana.
I always start with PBS.
Right. There's David Paterson, there's Deval Patrick, and there's Doug Wilder. So I would say that 46 states have not had black governors.
Right. But still, Alabama has a large proportion of African Americans, and it also has them much concentrated in the Democratic Party, where you would think they could have the nominee of their preference. As Archer Davis thought, he was taking them for granted and positioning himself for the white vote in November. And what happened was he lost 9 out of 11 black counties.
But Archer Davis, I think, from the moment he was elected to Congress in 2002, he felt that the way to be in Alabama, if he was ever had a statewide future there, was to run as a centrist, if not a conservative.
Sure.
And while he's African-American, first of all, he was the only black member of Congress to vote against the health care bill.
Not that anybody noticed. Of course, everybody noticed.
Exactly.
It was an enormously remarked upon phenomenon.
And there was a big battle among his staff, Archer Davis' staff. His congressional staff said, look, we have one of the poorest districts in the country. It's pocked with, terrible poverty in the 7th congressional district. You have to vote for it. Whereas his campaign staff said, this may not help us in our statewide bid to be governor.
And which way did he go?
Vote against it. So that was a problem. And also, Jesse Jackson was quoted as saying that you can't be a black man and vote against health care. I mean, that's a little
over the top in its own right.
But I mean, that's part of the emotions that went in there. And so there were a lot of black civil rights organizations run by Joe Reed, who's been a top African-American power broker in Alabama for many, many years, who basically, had his door open waiting for Archer Davis to come knocking, and he never did.
Because he didn't want that kind
of
campaign.
Right.
And hats off to him in this respect. I mean, to defend him, he tried to run as a non-racial candidate in a highly racially charged situation. He tried to bridge that gap in his own way. It didn't turn out to be the way to do it.
Yeah, the way he did it basically was to almost ignore African-American concerns
and
go after white vote. I mean, he voted against gay marriage. He voted against partial birth abortion. All these things that you would expect from a conservative. Anyway, there was also a lot of attention on the Republican side of it, and most of the attention was on an ad, the famous English-only ad of Tim James, son of former Governor Bob James, who may have made it into the July 13th runoff.
There's a potential recount there, or is there a certain recount?
We don't know. We do know that Bradley Byrne, the former schools chancellor, will make it into the runoff of the Republicans, but among the other two, State Senator Robert Bentley and Tim James are fighting it out for second place. We don't know who's going to do it there. Fourth place, by the way, was Roy Moore, the former State Supreme Court Chief Justice, who with the Ten Commandments.
So famous for his defense of the Ten Commandments. Is this not a bit shocking that with all of his fame for defending the Ten Commandments, Roy Moore would not have done better in this particular primary, finishing a poor fourth?
Well, he had run for governor once before in 2002 and finished a poor second to Bob Riley, who went on to be elected governor for two terms. And I think Roy Moore's time had come and gone. But it's interesting because either Tim James or Robert Bentley, if they make it into the runoff, is backed by Tea Party folks, whereas Bradley Byrne is more establishment business community. And they're still in that primary runoff. There could be the historic business interest versus Tea Party split in the Republican Party.
Still on that Republican side in Alabama, we had the fascinating result with respect to Parker Griffith. This was a man elected in 2008 as a Democrat, conservative Democrat, but elected in 2008 and serving in this Congress as a Democrat until last winter when he decided he probably had a better political future in the Republican Party because he didn't think he could get reelected as a Democrat. So he shifted over. He ran as a Republican. But as an incumbent, he was welcomed into the Republican Party here in Washington. And when he submitted this to the voters now in June, they clobbered him.
They clobbered him. It was like 51-33%. First of all, this is a district in northern Alabama that has never elected a Republican to Congress in history. But Republicans have been gaining strength. When he switched parties, he really blasted the Democrats. He blasted Barack Obama. He blasted the health care bill, said it was just, not right for Alabama. And he basically had the same kind of problem Arlen Specter had in Pennsylvania, the opposite way. Arlen Specter left a party that didn't like him and moved into a party that didn't trust him. And I think Parker Griffith did the same thing, even though there was no effort, no push from the Democrats to get him out of the Democratic Party. The Republicans did not trust him the moment he made the switch.
The primary voters did not.
Right.
Over on the Mississippi side, there was some interest in whom the Republicans would choose as their nominee against Travis Childress.
Childress, by the way, was the Democrat who won a special election in 2008 when Roger Wicker, the Republican congressman, was appointed to the Senate, and Republicans are dying to get that seat back.
And they have an excellent shot at getting that seat back, so this was one worth running for. They had a large primary field, but in the end, the establishment candidate, the person that the party was mostly behind, State Legislator Alan Nunnally, won easily.
And the other state that had to hold a primary on Tuesday was in New Mexico. And the story there was that for the third time in history, two women will be running against each other for governor. This is the seat that Bill Richardson is term limited.
That's right. And also, as an interesting side note, one of the Republican candidates for that gubernatorial nomination was the son of Pete Domenici.
I think his name was Pete Domenici Jr.
Yes. So in case anyone might miss that family connection just based on how many Domenicis there are, it was made clear.
And he finished a poor fourth. So obviously, you know, we talk about all the names. You know, Tim James in Alabama is the son of a former governor. Pete Domenici Jr. in New Mexico trying to capitalize perhaps on the name. It certainly did not work in New Mexico.
Next week on Tuesday, we have an extraordinary lineup of primaries, particularly out west. Let's start with California. Some of the latest polls show Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina reestablishing themselves as the clear front runners for the Republican nominations for governor and senator. But nobody's really sure yet.
Well, that's what it looks like. I mean, on the Senate race, it's been up and down between Tom Campbell, who's basically a moderate, or he'll call himself a conservative, but he's pro-gay rights. He's
some would say an outright liberal Republican, always was when he was in the
House. Or even worse, a demon sheep.
Well, without going all the way back to the demon sheep, Tom Campbell, though, in some polls, was running ahead of Carly Fiorina for some weeks.
Not any longer. Fiorina has taken the lead. Of course, she's spent a fortune. Tom Campbell, matter of fact, is off the air right now because he can't afford to keep up with her spending. But at the same time, polls show that he could beat Barbara Boxer and Fiorina could not. And that's what's so interesting about California Republicans when they go to the polls on Tuesday. Do they pick somebody who can beat Boxer who they just despise, or they just stick with somebody at least nominally is more conservative? And Sarah Palin has endorsed Carly Fiorina.
Yes, and Chuck DeVore is also in that race. And Chuck DeVore is a more
out-and-out
true conservative than either Fiorina or Campbell. So part of the question may be whether some of his voters peel off and choose between the other two, the front runners, or whether they stick with Chuck.
And speaking of polls, what's happening on the gubernatorial race is also interesting. Meg Whitman, for the longest time, seemed to have a slight lead over the likely Democratic candidate, Jerry Brown, the state attorney general and former governor. But she has been pushed so far to the right by her challenger in the
Steve Poizner
in the Republican primary that her numbers have dropped as well. She spent like $80 million so far.
And this is in a primary.
In a primary.
And so we can only imagine what she plans to spend between now and November.
Right. So you can't count her out, of course. But the fact is that the Republicans wanted self-financing candidates. They got them in two women in Whitman and Fiorina. But there is always a problem, as we learned with Rand Paul, that somebody who's never run for office before has either capability or the possibility of making a terrible mistake that could, you know, destroy the whole candidacy.
Well, or just could also prove to be a tremendous magnet to bringing people out in the primary, and maybe in November as well, could affect turnout in unexpected ways and be something of a wild card in that game. We're looking at a similar sort of situation next door in Nevada, where Sharon Angle, who is a Tea Party favored candidate and a sometime Fox commentator, a very conservative candidate, talks about getting rid of Medicare and Social Security, says we should try to phase them out. Not a good idea. She has taken the lead in the Republican primary there over also conservative, but maybe not quite so Tea Party, Sue Loudon, who had been the longtime front runner there for the nomination against Harry Reid this
fall. And Sue Loudon did talk about something, the famous quote about chickens and bartering and things like that.
In the old days, we used to pay the doctor by bringing him a chicken.
Which, of course, is propaganda. But more importantly, for all the talk about how vulnerable Harry Reid is, and we've said that, you know, he'll lose to any generic Republican, well, now it's no longer going to be a generic Republican. It will be somebody nominated on June 8th. For all the talk about how the end is near for Harry Reid, he could very well be reelected in November.
And just moving a little further east, we have an interesting runoff race in Arkansas that a few weeks ago nobody really expected to have happening. But we do have Bill Halter, the state lieutenant governor, running against their two-term incumbent, Blanche Lambert Lincoln.
And it's as nasty as it was during the regular primary.
It's nastier now.
The ads have come up again. SEIU is up again with a lot of pro-Halter, or should I say
anti-Lincoln.
Lincoln stuff. And so we talk about the anti-incumbency. I mean, we have Parker Griffiths going down. We have Alan Mollahan. We have Arlen Specter and Bob Bennett. Blanche Lincoln could very well lose her runoff on Tuesday.
Well, she's slightly trailing in the polls, but they're close and the polls are small sample. We don't really have a very good sense of who's going to turn out on this June 8th runoff, which was not normally going to be on the Arkansas calendar.
But we do know that Halter has outraised Lincoln for the runoff, so it's going to be very, very close. Well, before we forget, there's also an interesting gubernatorial primary, Republican primary in South Carolina.
Yes. Getting sexy again in South Carolina, I'm afraid.
Well, this is the weirdest part of all. Well, one, Nikki Haley is a state representative who the only woman in the race who's been accused of having an inappropriate physical relationship with some blogger. But the weirdest thing of all is that Mark Sanford came to Nikki Haley's defense this week.
Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, just what you want.
As a character witness.
That's right. You're going to have some kind of minor sex scandal, what you want is an endorsement from a guy who was a major sex scandal.
That's right.
And we cannot leave the subject of scandal without, of course, remembering the reaction we all had in 2000, August, Los Angeles, California, the Democratic National Convention, when Al and Tipper Gore shared what has become known as the kiss. And now, a decade later, to many people's amazement, we have the divorce.
Well, the separation, certainly. Of course, that kiss did last longer than the Florida recount that year. But all I can say is that we never saw it coming. You know, you always think that they had the perfect marriage. You think of the kiss. You think of them together all these years. And compared to the Clintons, you'd say, my goodness, how is it possible that the Gores don't last longer than the Clintons? Ultimately, it's what happens behind closed doors is deservedly private, and we just wish them both well.
That's it for this week's Political Podcast. You can follow NPR's political
coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rutan.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Oh, one last kiss. Oh, give me one last kiss. It never felt like this. No, never felt like this. You know I need your love. Oh, give me one last kiss. Oh, one more time. Oh, baby, one more time. It really is sublime. Oh, honey, so sublime. You know I need your love.